In this hour of the show, we will talk with poet and writer and NPR commentator Andrei Codrescu. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk in the MillerCom series tonight on the U of I campus. This is in the auditorium of Smith Hall on the title topic, Reinventing the Wheel, Original Capitalism in Dracula Land. Andrei Codrescu is professor of English at Louisiana State University and has published a number of books. And I'll mention just a few. A recent, most recent collection of poetry, It Was Today, New Poems by Andrei Codrescu, that came out last year. He's also written several novels, Casanova in Bohemia, Messiah and the Blood Countess, memoirs, Road Scholar, Coast to Coast Late in the Century, The Hole in the Flag, A Romanian Exile Story of Return and Revolution. Also has published several collections of essays, Zombification, Essays from NPR, and more recently, Hail Babylon, Looking for the American City at the End of the Millennium. And he has a new novel that is due out in May, titled Wakefield, published by Algonquin Books. So all of those are out there in the bookstore if you want to look at them. And he also will be giving a book signing while he is here, and I'm sure I have that information. In fact, here it is. He'll be doing a poetry reading and a book signing at the Illini Union Bookstore tomorrow. Tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. So if you're interested in meeting him, you can do that. And, of course, the program tonight, the MillerCom, is free and open to the public, and anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Well, good to be here, David.
You have been living now in the United States for almost 40 years. Is that right?
Well, it seems like it was only yesterday. But, 1966. Yeah. Until now, it's a number of years, yeah. Quite a few.
Do people still ask you about your identity? What do you think you are? Are you an American now?
Well, it's partly a good business because people do ask me to talk about what it's like to have been born somewhere else in another time and place in a different kind of world. So, yes, but I live in Louisiana now, and people often just ask me what part of Louisiana I'm from because they think my accent is from somewhere over there. But I do keep the accent, so I would say, yeah, I'm an American with an accent, like about 95% of us now.
You don't purposely keep it, do you? You just do?
Well, if I tend to lose it, I always can call my mother on the phone and she says, roll those R's harder. It's how you make a living, son.
When you were growing up in Romania, what did you know about the United States?
Well, we knew that, as my grandmother said, dogs walked around with pretzels on their tails. Loosely translated, sidewalks are paved with gold. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting place to dream about. And then in school, when I was in elementary school, our school books showed us tall buildings and men in top hats. And the caption said, the ugliest buildings in the world where workers are exploited and crushed. And that's about all I do. The buildings look pretty great to me even at the time, but not much.
When it came time to leave Romania, I think I remember reading that you had the possibility of going either to the United States, to Canada, or to Australia. And you said of those three places, the United States would be the place.
Well, my mother and I had the good fortune in 1965 to be bought, as it were, by the State of Israel, which was at the time buying freedom for Jews from Romania for $2,000 a head from the newly minted dictator of the country, Nicolae Ceausescu. And the same time, the West Germans were buying ethnic Germans about for the same amount of hard currency. So Ceausescu was making out, and we were lucky enough to get out. And so in transit, we applied for visas to different countries. I wanted to come to the United States because I was 19 years old, and I fancied myself a poet, and I was listening to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and I wanted to go to where the beat was. And then we were accepted meanwhile by Canada and by Australia, and I didn't want to go to any of those places because I had very bleak visions of my future if I went there. I just wanted to come here, and then luckily, happily, we were admitted into the United States.
So when you got here, How did that stack up with what you thought that it was going to be like?
Well, it was that great culture shock of first tremendous disappointment in the first few months, at least, because we went to Detroit, and it was still winter. It was gray. We'd come from Rome, where everything was in flower. The spring breezes were there, and I didn't know anybody, and I didn't drive, so I tried to find my way downtown to where the people were, and I couldn't find any people. Downtown closed at 6 p.m., and all the people went to the suburbs, and I wandered around trying to figure out what kinds of signs of human habitation and culture might exist in Detroit. I ended up standing over the John Lodge Expressway counting cars and trying to figure out whether yellow cars followed yellow cars and blue cars followed blue cars and so on. But that didn't last very long because even though I didn't speak English, I didn't know anybody. I ran into members of my generation gathered stealthily near the John Lodge Expressway in a place called the Writer's Workshop, which was a kind of beatnik gathering place with music and somewhat dark, where existentially desperate but wonderfully young people sat trying to figure out what goes on next, and I felt right at home.
You lived in a number of places. I think you were living actually in Baltimore when you started doing the commentaries for All Things Considered. Is that...
Well, yeah, from Detroit, I went to New York City, and then from New York to California, sort of following a generational flow, and lived in San Francisco, then in Sonoma County, then in Baltimore, and that's where I started being a productive citizen, writing articles for the newspaper, doing radio commentaries, editing a literary magazine, and teaching. All of it started at the same time in about 1983, 1984.
Right. So how did you end up in Louisiana?
Well, I just went down the river, and then the gravity makes it impossible to go back up. Well, that was a job. I went to Louisiana State University to teach, and I found that New Orleans was a very unique and unique place in the most unique place I'd seen so far, and very much suited to my temperament and my proclivities. Hmm.
We have a caller to bring in, so let's do that. In Champaign County, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. I've listened to Andrei Kandescu for a while, and I have a few questions I don't know if you could answer, but I'd like to give a try. One is whether you have any familiarity with your... I don't know if he's your countryman, but he comes from the same area, Jerzy Kaczynski, and if you have any comments about him and his work.
Well, I don't. I never met him. I read his books. I read The Painted Bird twice. I read it when it came out, and I enjoyed it very much, and then I read it years later after I heard all kinds of criticism, and it did seem to me more like an S&M novel than a... true, genuine Holocaust book, as it was originally advertised. But, you know, I have great sympathy for him and for his story, and I know that he was quite a character, and I knew one of his last girlfriends.
Yeah. Okay. I'll leave it at that and let someone else come on. Thank
All
you
right.
for speaking, and thank you for your ongoing witty and interesting comments and different perspectives on life.
Well, thank you. That makes me much happier.
All right. Thank you for the call. Bye. Well, other folks are certainly welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. How is your writing affected by being bilingual, and not just being bilingual, but having that other language be Romanian?
Well, I don't know, because my first language was German. My second was Hungarian, and Romanian was my third when I went to school. So I spoke Hungarian with my grandmother. I spoke German with my mother and the Fräulein who took care of me when my mother was working. I spoke German with some kids on the street. And when Romanian came in, it was already there was a mix of all kinds of things in there. So I find that at some level, probably in poetry particularly, there is a kind of urground or languages meet in a kind of a sonorous mud before they articulate ideas or articulate anything. So there is that level, but that's a very happy one, and it's a poetic one, and it doesn't happen that often. But I'm not conscious of being, you know, knowing any other language except, you know, I happened to make some trilingual pun, and then I chuckle at it myself because I'm sure not many other people will.
Hmm. How about the in terms of sensibility, maybe not so much in language?
Well, I really wouldn't know that either, but I think that all our sensibilities these days are Creole. They are Creolized, they are mixed, they are mongrelized. I think that we've adopted so many, English being the flexible language it is, it has taken so many things from other people. Other people speak English in different ways. They infuse it with tone, with color, with different ways of making constructions. So I think we all speak a language that gets increasingly harder to assign purely to any mode or aesthetic or single group of people.
Hmm. You went back to Romania in 1989. Was that the first time that you had been
I went there, you know, 2 days after the Ceausescu couple was executed. They were executed by, their cronies during the so-called revolution in Romania. I went there to cover it for National Public Radio, and I did some commentaries for Nightline.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it was December 27th that we actually got there 2 days after the execution, while the revolution, between quotation marks, was still going on.
Yeah. How had things, and obviously that was in a period of great change, had things changed between the time that you left and then, or how had things changed?
Oh, tremendously. When I left in the mid-60s, was a period of relative liberalization for writers, for the arts. There was some freedom of expression permitted. There was quite a flourishing, especially in poetry. There was a little bit of material well-being as well. There were more goods around. People felt as if things were changing. After the repression of the Czech revolt by the Soviets in 1968, things changed for the worse. Then dictator Ceausescu went to North Korea, and he came back determined to transform his country and his people into North Korea, which obviously was absurd. But it made for a very grim place. And so Romanians started living through worse deprivation, through poverty, through terrible misery all through the 80s. He also demolished half the capital of Bucharest, trying to make room for giant megalomaniac buildings to glorify his person. So things got much, much, much worse. So when I returned to Romania, the revolution, there was a popular revolt. I mean, I wouldn't call it a revolution, but there was such massive discontent, and the country looked so grim, so bleak, and people were hungry. They were hungry, I mean, literally hungry, but they were also felt as if they had been trapped behind a dark door. They didn't know what was going on the other side, and they were just immensely relieved to have heat and television and food and people from abroad to talk to openly.
I remember right after that happened, reading a lot of comment that people said, well, one should be careful about talking about just how much things had changed, and saying that, yeah, certainly the Ceausescus were gone, but that the people that took over weren't particularly different, and it was just a case where, you know, the names on the doors changed, the way the country ran really didn't change.
Well, there are two ways to look at that. I wrote a book, The Hole in the Flag, which is the history of that disappointment. There was a great deal of hope at the beginning. Then there was a great cosmetic change in the names of everything. Things became, they were not socialist anymore, they were something else. And there was a great deal of surface change. And then, of course, the second layer of apparatchiks who were with Ceausescu in those days rose to power. But that is all very true, and things were slow to change, and they still are very slow to change. But certain things did change irrevocably. Freedom to speak of is there. That can't, despite the sum of the measures that parliamentarians are trying to pass now, they can take that back. The country is open in many, many ways. So slowly, change is slow. But yes, I mean, you had an entire country without any kind of experience of democracy or what is called the free market or any of the notions that come very easily to us. So they had to learn, and they're still learning.
Those two things, the democracy and the free market, you know, you wonder what kind of expectations people had, which of those things were actually more important to them, and what they really got. And it seems that that, you know, maybe more than democracy, people got much more free market than they maybe knew what to do with, or it at least, you know, it changed their lives in ways that they hadn't really anticipated. And you know, one wonders whether some people who might say, you know, I'm not exactly sure this. We are better off now than we were.
Well, there is an experimental democracy there and somewhat of a free market. I mean, none of those things exist yet in any great measure. There is more or less of one or the other. They were coupled together at the beginning by liberal economists and thinkers who thought that you can't have one without the other, and I still believe that that's the case, despite, you know, some of the Chinese experience and so on. But I think there is resistance to both of them. First, some people got very rich, pretending to be Democrats and to be free marketers, when in fact they're feeding off the corpse of the state, and they're using their old secret police connection to squash the opposition and their enemies. And so, but another political class is slowly making its appearance, and things may be changing. Of course, all depends on the historical surroundings and, you know, the possible catastrophes of one kind or another.
Let me introduce again our guest. For anyone who doesn't recognize this voice, our guest is Andrei Codrescu. He's poet, novelist, essayist. He is editor of Exquisite Corpse, a literary journal, which you can find online at www.corpse.org. He's professor of English at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, has published collections of poetry, several novels, memoirs, travelogues, essays. Go down to the bookstore and look. He's also here on the campus to give a talk, and that's tonight. It's in the MillerCom series, 7:30 at the auditorium of Smith Hall on the U of I campus, and anybody is welcome to attend. If you don't often go down to the campus, you might keep in mind that parking is something of a problem, and we're told that you might think about looking at the Krannert lot after 5. You can park there. Also, there's a lot at Goodwin in Oregon, which is known as D15. And, of course, if you can find on-street parking after 6, you don't have to plug the meters. So keep that in mind. You might want to go down early if you're wanting to go down and hear Andrei Codrescu. We have several people here with questions, and we'll start with Champagne, line 1.
Hi. Hello. I have two questions. They're quite different. The first one is I've known a couple of Romanian women, and from their life stories, I got the impression that Romania had been pretty repressive towards women, or its patriarchy was fairly repressive. And I was wondering what that was a result of, whether it was some tradition, Christian or other, and what happened under the patriarchal dictatorship or some kind of repressive communist government. And what was the situation for women before the fall of the dictator and since, and what future do you see for Romanian women?
Well, those are good questions. The dictatorship was overtly, like all the communist countries, making room for women in the market, in the job market, and there were quite a few women professionals, doctors, engineers, and so on. But at the same time, there was a policy around the 1970s, some kind of order from the dictator for every Romanian family to produce 5 children for the state. So, and abortion was made illegal. And from that point on, there was a very long, tragic story that continues. To this day, a lot of women died trying to have illegal abortions. Many children were abandoned, hence the terrible story of the Romanian orphans, which we still hear about now. There are, you know, still orphanages in a terrible shape in Romania. Women had, of course, because of old of the old tradition, had to also do all the cooking, the housework, as well as working and making all these children. So yes, it was a pretty bad situation, and their stories haven't been yet told. I think that's still one of the failings of the new of these new days, that those stories haven't been told in their entirety. There's still some taboo about it. So,
yeah, I was wondering about violence and abuse in the home. But my other question then was how it was that you became a professor of English, given that you arrived not speaking English. Was that because you were always a writer and that was the language in which you could be understood?
Well, yeah, I mean, I sort of use language like I use public transportation. Get on the bus and see if it gets me there. No, I think probably that... in this country, we do things like buy, you know, cars from Japan and shoes from Italy and English professors from Romania.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
Right. Well, people must have regarded you as an exotic. One of the things that would be nice to have in your collection.
Well,
you
know? I'm not very exotic to myself, but then, you know, as my friend Ted Bergen used to say, nobody's a character to themselves.
Urbana is next, line number two.
Yeah, hi. I love your commentaries. They're really fun. Well, I have two questions. Did you do a film? I think I remember seeing a really hilarious film where you comment on American customs. That's the first question. Did you?
Yes, it's called Rhodes Scholar,
R-O-A-D. That's it. Oh, and it's wonderful. Does it ever appear again? I mean, is it on tape?
Should still be at your Blockbusters, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
I think it's on some recorded medium. You could rent it. Yeah.
Yeah, I just remember there was one scene where you went through a drive-in food place. I can vaguely remember that. In any case, I recommend it. It was great fun. And the other thing is, my parents came from Romania, as I learned recently when we did genealogical digging, and were Jewish. And I saved a New York Times, which I have in front of me, from September 14th, which sounds, they came from Yash.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting. And so my question is about, is there a revival of the Jewish theater? They talk about the Romanian Ministry of Culture to commemorate the Yiddish theater creator, intellect down at the heel intellectual named Avram Goldfaden and so on. And they talked about the theater scene in Romania. But is there a Jewish presence that's...
Well, it's a very good question. I'm Jewish too, and there are not many Jews left in Romania, so this business of reviving the Yiddish theater intrigued me as well, because I wasn't sure who the audience was, since even the few Jews left there are assimilated, and I doubt if any of them still speak Yiddish. So, it's an odd idea. I'm not sure what it is.
Did you go to that they had a festival of Yiddish theater?
No, I've never seen it, but one of the great Romanian actresses, Maya Morgenstern, who did perform Yiddish theater, and she's also on the national stage in Romania, most recently, actually. She'll be very well known because she played the mother of Jesus in the Mel Gibson movie, which I read a long interview with her, and she made an interesting defense of taking the job.
Right. Well, I plan to come tonight. Would you like this article?
Yes, yes.
I mean, it's quite a long article, and it tells also about the beer and restaurants and things like that. But,
I see. Okay.
And then they talk about that wonderful song, Romania, Romania.
Oh, I see. It's a tourist trap. That's what it is.
No.
The Ministry of Tourism has figured it out.
Oh, it's the New York Times. It's the New York Times.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
I'll try to see you tonight. But it's very interesting to know about that.
Right. All right. Well, thank you for the call.
Okay,
let's
bye.
Continue. We have another caller. This is also Urbana, line three. Hello.
Mr. Kondrescu, with your encounter of the United States beginning in Detroit, that's one picture of America. I'd like to hear your thoughts when you began to encounter Louisiana and New Orleans. That's a totally different part of the United States. So anything that sticks in your mind from those initial encounters?
Well, that was much later. And going to New Orleans, I felt like I went back to some Mediterranean part of Europe or a Caribbean island where I've never been, a completely different culture, and I instantly felt the laissez-faire attitude of the natives and the lassitude and many things in common with the Balkans. Nobody's on time for anything. If you actually show up on time for a party, the hostess hasn't even gotten out of bed. So a certain level of mild corruption that pertains to the...
Mild?
Well, it was mild until the casinos got there. Then it got less mild and a lot.
Are you talking about political corruption?
More crude. Yeah. Well, I like a certain amount of political corruption, because if that didn't exist, you know, I wouldn't be here talking to you, because before the war, when Romania was an ally of the Germans, is some corruption that kept some of us alive. So, you know, I have a healthy respect for it. Now, after, as I've said, the casinos and, you know, the big interest, big money came to Louisiana, then things, there were too many pigs at the trough and things got rough. But, you know, before, the modus operandi before was fairly gentle, I think.
Thank you.
All right. Other calls are certainly welcome. I'd like to talk with Andrei Codrescu, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I remember the commentary you did where you talked about shaving off your mustache.
Yes.
There are still a lot of pictures around of you, of the old you. When you show up now, people say, wait a minute, who are you? And until, of course, you open your mouth, and then they know perfectly well.
Well, it took me all those years until 1997 in Venice, Italy, before I realized that Stalin was really, really, really dead. And I could get rid of my mustache.
That's very, as a man who's had a lot of facial hair over my 51 years, I know that's not an easy thing. I don't know. Did you have that experience? You shaved it off and you looked at yourself in the mirror and said, who is this guy?
I didn't recognize myself. My mother didn't recognize me. She claims I was born with a mustache. Yeah, it's strange to reappear to yourself after years, but why not? I mean, I always like to make up poets and new people. I would love to have just a closet full of bodies to take out when I go for different occasions.
Pity that you can't, in the old Soviet mode, go back and remove all the mustaches from the photos. You could have them retouched. Like the commissar vanishes, it's the poet's mustache vanishes. That would be a good thing. You have a new novel that is going to be out in May, right? Wakefield. You want to talk a little bit about Wakefield?
Everything I've ever wanted to say for the past 20 years is in this book. It's a spectacular book. It's wonderful. Wakefield comes from, the title comes from a story by Nathaniel Hawthorne called Wakefield in Twice Told Tales about, it was a little newspaper item that Hawthorne picked up at the end of the 19th century. Apparently a English clerk leaves his home and disappears for 20 years, and it turns out that he's taken quarters across the street from his wife, and he watches, and 20 years later he comes back. It's a baffling story, and Hawthorne's genius is not to try to figure psychologically out what happened. He is mainly wondering what Wakefield did for 20 years, and concludes that Wakefield had no imagination. And so I took the character of Wakefield and placed him in the 90s, in the boom.com booming 90s in America, and he's a different character, and he makes a bargain with the devil. It's a Faustian story, classical Faustian story. He makes a bargain with the devil and promises the devil to give himself fully to the dark powers if he fails to find his authentic life within a year. And so he has a year to travel and try to find what he calls his authentic life.
Mm.
And that's the story.
And that will be out in May, so people can look forward to it. I managed it. Someone sent me a copy, a galley, and I started to read it, and it's very, very good. All I must say that I'm only just a little ways in it, past the prologue where he meets the devil, and at the point where he's sitting in the bar with the Russian cab driver. I guess
right.
I'm just about as far as that. How do you approach writing dialogue? There's a lot of conversation in the book, and it feels really good, and I'm not sure that writing natural sounding dialogue is all that easy, because obviously not everybody can do it.
That's an excellent question. I like to think that I have a good ear. I also pass these very carefully through the ear and the eye of my wife, Laura, who is an absolutely great reader and also has this very acute ear for the English language. And so she picks up on things that are wrong. But then, of course, there are quite a few characters in the book that speak with an accent. And so I try to do that without satirizing them too much, unless, you know, of course, there is a reason to do that. But so it's difficult. But, you know, it's the question, it's the kind of miraculous thing that screenwriters or playwrights do. Playwrights certainly can make people sound right. And in most cases, they have the help of actors. They have the help of people who hear, who listen, and know whether something sounds right or not. Yeah.
I don't. By this point, I think I've got your voice in my head so effectively, so that anytime I read something you've written, I can hear you reading it somehow. Like even this book, all the characters to me sound like you.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that. They're supposed to be totally different.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Let's go to Charleston, line one, right here. Hello.
Hi. I confess I'm homesick, and I missed most of the interview, but when I heard who was on, I had to call and say, thank you so much.
Well, my pleasure.
For years, I have listened when you've had your commentaries on NPR, and every time I know you're coming on, I know I'm going to have the privilege of hearing a quirky, unfamiliar, totally funny, quaint, superior.
Well, thank you. You can put that in a letter and send it to NPR and tell them to put me on every day.
I should. You're right, because you should be on every day. I look forward to it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the comment. Let's go next to another Champaign County caller here. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. The Exquisite Corpse is like a surrealist game, and I'm trying to develop a question or get you to start talking about what surrealism means. It's like, how can you talk about the tradition of surrealism? Because it's supposed to be antithetical to traditional. And I also think of what the comedian who did Vatican Rag, whose name is all of a sudden is escaping me, said
Tom
about.
Tom Lehrer?
Yeah, okay. Tom Lehrer quit doing parodies when Kissinger got the Nobel Peace Prize. So, I mean, life seems so surreal right now. It's almost like, what does one say about surrealism in these times? I don't know if you share that
stance. Well, I had that impression as soon as I got here that America is de facto surrealist and things are just bound to become more surrealist, and they certainly are not disappointing. The Exquisite Corpse is a journal I started in 1983, and it was named after the surrealist game of collaboration. And what interested me was the collaborative spirit of the surrealist poets and writers who made up this game in the late 20s and 1930s, how a group, a gang, really can make art and together and think together along certain lines. And a surrealist experiment and the surrealist spirit is certainly not dead for artists. It's quite useful still. And the magazine reflects some of that. But in terms of orthodox surrealism, I mean, clearly surrealism has a history, just like everything else, if it hangs around long enough. And so it becomes collectible and it becomes a pile of objects. But the main thrust of surrealism seemed to me always the spirit of it, and rather than the end process, which is to make certain things that can have certain values on the market or not. But my magazine is not, strictly speaking, surrealist. It's just provocative.
But it shares the idea of, well, it's more collaboration, I guess I'm understanding, but the idea of breaking through the what the French call the quotidien, the everydayness of everything, and seeing how, and I think that's what you do. Maybe what you do in your commentaries was what they do for me is to take me past what and see things not necessarily ironically, but
Well, I try, you know. I mean, there's a place where the surrealists are very interested in the unconscious, and especially as Freud described it at a certain point, you know, and I don't think anybody has an unconscious anymore. We are just unconscious.
Well, there's also, I mean, one thinks of surrealism, they also think of the poser, and I'm forgetting his name too, the melting clock, et cetera, who seemed to be more of an opportunist.
It's 100 years since the birth of Salvador Dali, and
yes,
one And he's getting reassessed in major ways because he was quite an extraordinarily creative person who sort of got a bad rep toward the end there because he was making too many things and collaborating with jewelry designers and fashion people. And actually, those things are quite remarkable if you see them. He's created thousands of objects. They're all quite interesting.
Well, Bunuel has, there's a biography of Bunuel that has the interactions that
he had. Bunuel trashes him because they used to be good friends, he and Lorca and Bunuel, and then they all became enemies later on because they had disputes over the early movies.
Well, the political dimension of the Surrealist movement, Bunuel was smuggling things, and the anti-colonial movement in France started out of the Intellectuals of 100, which were out of the Surrealist movement. I actually stumbled on an untold story that I still haven't seen told, that there were certain Arab women painters who were painting Surrealist at that time of Breton. There was a display in the Parisian Museum of the Arab World, and I'd never heard of the story, and I still haven't heard anybody chronicle that.
But, I don't know what to say there.
Thank you.
All right. I think that I read in one of the interviews or pieces about you that I read that you actually distanced yourself some from the term surrealist, that you didn't particularly like to apply it to yourself and what you do. So you don't think you're a surrealist.
No, I don't think I'm a surrealist. I think everything else is surrealist. I'm just somebody who tries to make sense of what they notice. I mean, just stay on my toes and try and figure out what it is I just saw. And sometimes that involves reading what I just wrote, and that's a surrealist experience. Or actually try to listen in more than in a less habitual sense. But no, I'm not a deliberate surrealist. I'm not out to make weird things. In fact, I hate weird things.
All right, let's talk with somebody else here. Let's go to Urbana, line 3.
Hello.
Yes.
There was a woman who called a little bit ago, and she talked about a movie, a comedy that our guest made. What was the name of that?
Rhode Scholar, R-O-A-D Scholar.
What was it again, please?
Rhode Scholar.
Rhode Scholar.
Yes.
Yeah, it was done for public television.
Well, it was a film, actually. It was in theaters as well. There was
there was a theatrical release.
There was a PBS version, one-hour PBS version, okay. Yeah. It's just me in a red Cadillac, a convertible Cadillac, driving in winter through this country, finding strange cults.
Oh.
So it's more of a documentary. I don't know. Is it?
It's a documentary of tiny-scale communism.
Yeah.
And tell me how to spell your name, please.
Just like secret code and rescue at sea, CODRESCU, and then you pronounce it like code and rescue, so you get it.
COD.
RES.
RES.
CU.
CU.
EU. Is that your last name?
Yes.
Yeah. First name. That's all I'm telling you.
First name is Andre.
Andre.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to trying to find that.
Sure. And I made up that name, by the way.
You made up your name?
Yes, but I won't talk about that.
No, you can't. I'm sorry.
That's
you can't.
Not your real name?
You can't get away with that.
No, I made it up because it's hard to pronounce and hard to spell so that people can call me and say, how do you spell that? And that always gives me pleasure.
I think he's pulling our leg. But then with this man, you're never quite sure.
Okay, well, I'm enjoying the program.
All right, well, thank you for the call. We have about 15 minutes left, and we're speaking with the poet known as Andre Codrescu. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana, going to give a talk tonight. He will be doing a poetry reading and a book signing at the Illini Union Bookstore tomorrow at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So if you would like to meet him, you can do that. And tonight's talk, the Millercom talk that I've mentioned, that's also open to the public, 7:30 at the auditorium of Smith Hall. So you can go down there as well. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. That's the number if you'd like to call us. And next we go to Champaign and line 1. Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, first I want to say I read a few years ago a collection of essays, political essays, I believe, by, I can't pronounce his name.
Codrescu, okay. Secret Code and Rescue C, put them together.
Okay, but I was very impressed by those. But I have several questions for you. There was a murder at the University of Chicago a number of years ago. a Romanian professor of comparative literature, I believe.
Ion Culiano.
And there's a book written about that murder. And has that ever been solved?
No. Professor Culiano was a professor of comparative religions, the heir to the great comparatist Mircea Eliade, another Romanian scholar, and his murder was a very mysterious. Was an assassination, and I have reason to believe it was a political assassination. Probably the first assassination of a foreign professor inside an American university in 1991, and I think that he was assassinated by some rogue group of the Romanian secret police that didn't like his imagination, literally, because he was writing a series of political articles and also a series of stories in which he used this fantastic country he invented, quote-unquote, to talk about Romania, and it was uncomfortably accurate. And I have a feeling that some paranoid philosophers in the secret police murdered him.
Okay. And my other question, this is a little bit, I'm not quite sure if I can phrase it properly, but in the beginning, or approximately the early part of the last century, the 20th century, there was a tremendous amount of great, in my opinion, really great literature, such as Thomas Mann, Joyce, Beckett, Eliot, Pound, and so forth. There doesn't seem to be anything since approximately the 1950s that of the last century, of course, that really equal that. And or am I just misperceiving that? Or there just does not seem to be any truly, except for yourself, of course, but any truly really, really great literature out there. And I'm wondering if that's what your opinion of that is, sir.
Well, that's a complicated issue, but I can tell you that beginning yesterday, March 7th, I declared the age of impotence dead in literature. And starting this year, we'll see tremendous works. And there are already great works of poetry. There are lots of poets writing. There are writers of every kind. So there has never been a more fertile ground. And I think we're living in a real golden age of writing. But it's hard to find it because a lot of it is published by small publishers.
I see. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, who would you recommend? Who do you really like?
Well, I edited two anthologies of American poetry, one from the pages of Exquisite Corpse, the journal I edited. It's called Thus Spake the Corpse, Volume 1 and Volume 2, and there are a lot of writers in there. I edited an anthology called Up Late, American Poetry Since 1970, and there are 220 poets in there, and I think half of them are great. Hmm. And then, and then with Laura Rosenthal, I edited an anthology called American Poets Say Goodbye to the 20th Century. And these are poems written specifically to say goodbye to the 20th century. And there are an awful lot of good poems in there. So, you know, I like a lot of individual works, but then, of course, there are certain writers that I'll always read because it's always news when a new book by, you know, obviously Marquez comes out, or a book by Kundera, or a book by Robert Creeley. Mm-hmm.
We have about 10 minutes left with Andrei Codrescu. If someone wants to call in, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I read, this is a quote from you, and it comes from some public radio station's website, where you said, "I've made enough friends, thanks to NPR, to have a place to hide if I ever needed it in every city in the United States. I've also used some of my listeners' stories in ways that were not always nice. Writer, after all, this is my secret. I'm not half as nice as most of my listeners. I am bad. Very bad. Sorry." So, which I enjoyed very much.
I must have been bad when I said that.
I guess. You still had the mustache in those days, I guess.
Right, that's probably what hid a multitude of sins. I have given up on crime.
What sort of experiences, I wonder, as you have traveled around, do you have? Because certainly, as I think you say here, that's or maybe it was in something else, that it's virtually as soon as you start to speak, there's someone who will know who you are, who will recognize that voice. And I just wonder what sort of experiences you've had, you know, meeting people.
Well, meeting people because they understand my voice, that there haven't been great experience. I mean, it's always weird because they catch you very quickly. Unlike when people recognize somebody's face, they look and then they give you a fraction of a second to put on a public mask, but when they hear your voice, they listen for a while and then they pounce, and so it's not such a great experience. But I meet people when I travel, and extraordinary things happen when I travel. We were at a restaurant last night called Bracco, and I discovered a new part of the cow that didn't exist before called hanger steak, which the poet, the menu poet, that's what I call them, the people who recite menus in America now, the menu poet described this as a part somewhere between the shoulder and the flank that was apparently hidden from sight for I don't know how many years. It reminded me of how we used to discuss Romanian pigs. They used to say, how are our socialist pigs better than all other pigs? And you know, the correct answer was they have another part. They have a hidden, they have more parts, and they give themselves willingly. But yes, that was quite extraordinary. I didn't know there was such a thing as hanger steak. If you remember, you know, an old traveler and being introduced to a whole new section of cow.
Let's go to Urbana, line one, for another caller. Hello.
I heard you say the words Vatican Rag. Is that a movie? Did you say that was a movie?
No, I think the caller, it was the caller anyway, who was referring to a satiric song that was written by a fellow named Tom Lehrer, who recorded a number of things many, many years ago. I don't know when he was at the peak of his work, in the 1960s, maybe. And then he quit. He just stopped. And I think a lot of people still revere his songs. I'm sure they're still available on recording somewhere if you go down to the library. Yes, it's a song.
It's a song.
It's a song.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Way back earlier in the conversation, you were talking about America and American culture and used the term Creole, which describes New Orleans culture and the mix of all the influences. And maybe New Orleans is a place where that kind of mix is obvious in a way that here to us it's not. You go different places, you're going to see that mix. But I think what some people would say is that, you know, if you don't see that mix where you live now, you better get used to it because there's no going back. It seems, however, something that we really don't know how to think about, how to get used to, how to work with it, and a lot of people are resisting the inevitability.
Well, when I came to America in 1966, this country was very boring. In Detroit, Michigan, for instance, there was one Chinese restaurant of the old variety, the Mandarin Chinese, called Ho Ho Inn. And that was about the extent of exotic food. There were some Greek restaurants. In 20 years, America's tastes have changed. Our tongue our taste is spicier. We like more color. I think this country is fundamentally absorbing all sorts of vividness and in color and in taste and in sensation. And this is what we have to look forward to, and I think it's a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's possible that we are actually embracing that change in ways that are deeper than just the fact that now salsa outsells ketchup?
Well, I think it starts with salsa, and then after you consume the salsa, an unseen process begins to take place at the organic level that changes your way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Next, let's talk with a champagne caller here, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to call in and inform the previous caller. The song Vatican Rag is on an album called That Was the Year That Was, and I believe the year was 1965, and it was from a TV show called That Was the Week That Was, for which Tom Lehrer wrote songs. So there is an album called that, and I think it's available on CD now. Record, of course.
I would think that that his albums must still be available because I know he did record albums with his song commentary and parodies on them. And I would think that and there's enough interest in them. I would think that they have to still exist. But,
right.
You know,
I think they're now available CDs, and the album is That Was the Year That Was.
Okay. Very good. So.
And thanks for being on the show. And I enjoy your accent.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. No one knows that they have an accent. They sound perfectly normal to themselves. Yeah, indeed. We're just about at the point here we're going to have to finish. Maybe I'll try to squeeze one more caller here. We'll go to line two in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I understand you were a supporter of the Clinton war in Kosovo at the time. Have you had any occasion to rethink that since then? I know that's a heck of a question to ask with a minute or two left.
No.
That's still your view.
Yes.
All right. Well, you want to go any further with that?
No.
No. Well, we're pretty much at the point we have to stop in any case. I want to, again, tell people who are listening that if you would like to hear more from our guest, Andrei Codrescu, he'll be giving a talk. This is in the MillerCom series, Reinventing the Wheel, Original Capitalism in Dracula Land. Tonight, 7:30 in the auditorium of Smith Hall. That's on South Matthews in Urbana on the U of I campus. And it's open to anybody who would like to attend. Also, Andrei Codrescu will be doing a poetry reading and a book signing at the Illini Union Bookstore, also on the campus. That's tomorrow afternoon at 4. So another opportunity to meet him. And you can go down to the bookstore and you can look for his books. There are a number of collections of poetry, several novels, essays, and memoirs, travelogues. All of that is there. And then you can look for that new novel he just mentioned real quickly. It's titled Wakefield. It will be published by Algonquin Books. And I think late May is,
yes.
Is that? And then, of course, also, if you're interested in Exquisite Corpse, you can see that online at www.corpse.org. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.